Greetings and welcome back to the OU.org and www.etshalom.com. In our continuing study of the book of Shmuel, book of Samuel, Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph, today we're going to study the 11th chapter, which picks up immediately after Shaul has been officially and publicly crowned, although, as we will see, not ultimately crowned, but we will not see that in this chapter. And as I mentioned a few days ago, Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11, presents us with several components of what we might refer to as closing circles, resolving tension that was raised at the end of the book of Shoftim. And I will point them out as they come along. If we recall, back in Perek Chet, and again in Perek Yod, the people's insistence on a king was not motivated by a desire to have a particular political system or to imitate the nations around them in the deification of a king, which is what some suspect, but is chiefly motivated by their desire for security and their fear of the Plishtim. We now suddenly hear about another enemy coming not from the southwest, but rather from the east, who threatens Am Yisrael, and to whom Shaul is called. The context is somewhat strange because it comes out of nowhere, and for that, at the end of this year, I will mention a curious addendum and the curious source from where it comes. Vayal Nachash HaAmoni. So Nachash, which as we will find out, is likely a title name rather than a personal name of the king of Ammon, comes up. Vayichan al Yavesh Gilad. Now Yavesh Gilad is a place that we are familiar with. We know where it is. It's near Wadi Yabes, which is just on the other side of the Jordan River in the Gilad, south of the Kinneret. And he came in and camped there. We know Yavesh Gilad from the end of the book of Shoftim. And in chapter 20 or chapter 21, in the very end of the book, in the story of Pilegesh B'Givah, when the people were stuck because there were 600 survivors from the Shevet of Binyamin, and they needed wives, and none of the men could give their daughters as wives to these men based on the oath that they took. They first went and found that the people in Yavesh Gilad had not come to participate in the war against Binyamin, and as such were liable based on their agreement, liable for death, and they massacred everyone except for the young women, who then they brought to the people of Binyamin. Which, by the way, raises a very awkward question, and that is, if everyone in Yavesh Gilad was wiped out, who are the residents here who are now being threatened by Nachash HaAmoni? And we'll get to that also in a few moments. So, Vayichan Yavesh Gilad, literally, he camped upon Yavesh Gilad, but it means far more than that. It means that he set up an army camp of attack against the place of Yavesh Gilad. Vayimru kol anshei Yavesh el Nachash krot lanu vrit v'na'avdeka. And the people of Yavesh turned to Nachash, and they surrendered, and they said, make a covenant with us, and we will be your slaves. That's a form of surrender. But they insisted that he make a treaty, which would obviously be a treaty, first and foremost, of non-destruction and of some form of sustenance, that they would not be deprived of their livelihood or of their life. What is Nachash's response? Here is how I will cut the breach. We'll talk about that in a moment. I want to poke out every right eye, and I will make it a shame on Yisrael. Now, we need to spend a few minutes looking at this pasuk, and to do that properly, we have to go back to the end of the previous pasuk with the utilization of a verb with which we are all familiar, and that is the verb used throughout Tanakh to denote making a covenant is not la'asot brit, lachtom brit, la'asher brit, but rather lichrot brit, to cut a covenant. And the reason for that is something we find both in Tanakh as early as Genesis 15, Bereshit Tetvav and Brit Ben Matarim, and more pronouncedly and more obviously in Yirmiyahu Lamed Daled, the 34th chapter of the book of Jeremiah. But we also have lots of external documentation that supports it, and that is that the method of making treaties in the Near East, in the ancient world, was for the two signatories to the treaty, or the liege and the vassal, to take an animal and cut the animal in half, and put the animal on the two halves of the animal on the outside, and they would sit and sign the treaty between the animals, and the implication was that anyone who violates the terms of this agreement, this is what will happen to him. is what will happen to him. I remember that wording, because in our parak we will see a variation on it. But that is the implication there, and that is exactly what happens in Yirmiyahu Lamed Daled. The interested reader is encouraged to take a look at the 34th chapter of Jeremiah and see the context. In any case, that's why the verb used, lichrot, is appropriate here. And yet, it's played upon by Nahash himself. Here is how I will cut a brit with you, not to make a covenant, but I will cut out your eye. Kol lechem kol ein yamin. And I'm going to make it a cherpa, a shame on all of Yisrael. Now, this phrasing itself is somewhat bizarre. So we need some context, both from Tanakh and from some external documents that will help us understand what Nahash is implying with this phrase and why it would be a shame on all of Israel if the people of Yavesh Gilad have an eye poked out. If we look in Parshat Mishpatim, we see a very curious halacha, and that is that if a man knocks out the tooth or knocks out the eye of his slave, what's called commonly shein v'ayin, then the slave goes free. And halachically, we expand that to 24 different limbs, sugyan masechet kiddushin, but nonetheless, the way that the Torah presents it is specifically an eye and a tooth. What's being implied here? Why would the Torah have to legislate that if you knock out the eye of your slave, the slave would go free? We find out that in the ancient world, not only did masters have total rights over their slaves, but sometimes they would even brand them, and although this sounds counterproductive, they would even brand them as slaves so that they could not run away and find sanctuary elsewhere because everyone recognized them as a slave, but they would brand them by poking out an eye or by in some other way disfiguring them. Which means that, as odd as that would sound, which explains why the Torah is legislating against it and saying, if you try to brand your slave that way, it's an Eved Kanani nonetheless, instead of him being your perpetual slave with your mark on him, now he will always be free and not be able to be enslaved. So the Torah is legislating against it. Nonetheless, that evidently was a practice. If that's the case, then what Nahash is saying here is not just that I'm going to wound you and that will be the shame, but I'm going to mark you as slaves and that will be the shame. And this helps us to explain a very curious passage we're going to get to in 6 days in Perek Yud Zayin, and that is the interaction between David and Goliath. And really it starts with the interaction between Goliath and the army, and then later with David, where Goliath claims, I have shamed your army. Send me a man to fight against me. And David keeps saying, who is this Plishti, this Philistine, who shames our army and shames the army of the living God? Come, I'm going to take him, etc., etc. And that's his motivation, to remove the shame and alleviate the shame from Am Yisrael. Why is there a shame? What is there a shame in what Goliath has said? He hasn't said anything shameful. Except if you look carefully at his opening salvo, he says to them, you are all slaves to Shaul, and I am a plishti. You send one guy against me, and whoever wins will enslave the other people. But his claim, you are slaves, that is itself the cherpa. To call Am Yisrael slaves is indeed the cherpa. And this is something that we see several other times in Tanakh, and specifically with the use of the word cherpa. And as an example, we go to the book of Yoshua, Parakeh, Joshua chapter 5, which those of you studying with the OU Nachyomi did not too long ago. You find that in that chapter, after Bnei Yisrael cross the Jordan River and come into Gilgal, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands Yehoshua to do a mass Brit Milah on all of the Jews who were born in the desert and did not have Brit Milah. And once that is done, Hashem says, Hayom hasiroti et cherpat, Hayom galoti et cherpat Mitzrayim aleichem. I have rolled away, he's making a play on the word Gilgal, I have rolled away the shame of Mitzrayim from you. What does this mean? So the commentators each has his own approach to understanding what the shame of Egypt is, whether it's the licentiousness of Egypt, or the fact that we look like Egyptians, or the claim of the Egyptians that we were going to die in the desert, and the reality is that that blood was the blood of Milah, so Rashi goes. But there's another way to approach it, and that is that the shame of Egypt was the shame of slavery. And that shame of slavery, the being branded as slaves, is only removed when we brand ourselves as slaves to God. And therefore, by branding ourselves permanently with Brit Milah as slaves to God, we remove the possibility of being shamed as being slaves to any human force, which of course was the major point of the Exodus. They are not your slaves, Pharaoh, they are my slaves, God says. And that would also explain another curious passage where Shimon and Levi, or the brothers, say to the people of Shechem that we cannot allow our sister to marry a man who has foreskin because it is a cherpa. Why is it a cherpa? Because we consider it to be a shame not to be branded as the slaves of God via Brit Milah, and therefore we consider it a cherpa if she would be married to such a man. In any case, that seems to be what Nachash is saying. Not just that I'm going to poke out your eyes and you're going to be maimed, but also that you will be branded as slaves, and that will be the shame. All right, well, how do the people react? So the elders say, Heref lanu shivat yamim, give us 7 days. Nishtacha malachim b'chol gvul Yisrael. We'll send messengers throughout the borders, throughout the boundaries. If nobody will come and save us, then we'll come out to you. Meaning, we'll come out to you and, well, unclear, are we going to fight you? Are we going to resist you? Are we going to give you our right eye? What does it mean? They left it unclear. However, the king evidently was willing to play this game. Now, parenthetically, I mentioned that the people coming to Yavesh Gilad and Nachash coming and attacking them has a curious history. The text says nothing about it. But in Josephus's Antiquities, he relates what was evidently a common midrash at the time, that Nachash had first attacked the citizens of Reuven and Gad, who are the two major tribes that are bordering his territory on the east bank, and had massacred many of them, and according to Josephus, I don't know where he got it from, 7,000 of them ran away to Yavesh Gilad, which now explains why there are people there, because Yavesh Gilad was now an uninhabited area after the massacre in the war of Pelegish Pegivah. It's now inhabited by the remnant of Reuven and Gad who have escaped. And what had he done to the members of Reuven and Gad? He had poked out their eyes, branding them as slaves, and now came after these who had run away. Which now explains the next thing that happens. So the messengers go out, Ve'avoh malachim givat Sha'ul. Now, it doesn't say that they went everywhere else, although that's what they said they were going to do, but they came to Givat Sha'ul. What's very curious here, and this is the first time I'll make note of this, but there will be many other times, is that Sha'ul has just been crowned king, and yet he's still in Givah. He hasn't moved to some larger city or established a capital. He has done nothing royal in the sense of establishing a government, establishing a building a palace, making any move to move the Aron somewhere. None of that has happened, and they come to Givat Sha'ul, and the messengers came and told the people what was happening, and all the people cried. Now, why did they cry? Did they cry because they had such compassion for their friends in Yavesh Gilad, and they were concerned with them? All the evidence we have indicates that that's not the case, because if that were the case, they would simply move to go and help them, assemble a large enough army to go and help them. But evidently they are crying because they anticipate that if Nachash has not just hurt people in his own territory, but is now chasing to the east, to the west, then they're going to be next. They're in line. And so therefore they're crying out of a sense not only of helplessness, but also of desperation and dread. So now what happens? V'hinei Sha'ul ba'achrei ha'bakar min ha'sadeh. And Sha'ul comes in following the cattle from the field. He's plowing out in the field. In other words, Shaul, who has just been made king of Israel, said, okay, I'm king. And now he goes back, but he gotta make a living, so he goes back to the field, and he's plowing in the field. Not very royal. Why is everybody crying? So they told him what happened. And what happened? We have to explain this word, vatitzlach. The word lahatzliach, which is commonly translated and in modern Hebrew means to be successful. Makes no sense here whatsoever. The Spirit of God was successful on him. Makes no sense. The truth is that the root sadi lamed chet actually means to happen very fast. And therefore, in this case, Vatzitzlachu Achalim HaShaul means the Spirit of God came very quickly on Shaul. And that indeed is what the word means throughout Tanakh. So for instance, when Yosef is described as an Ish Matzliach, it means that he was successful very quickly. His star rose very quickly. When Hashem says to Yoshua, Ki az tatzliach et rachecha, it means you will be able to accomplish your act very quickly. And that's what happens here. So the Spirit of God, and those interested, take a look in the Rambam in the second section of Moreh Nevuchim, where he talks about what the 11 levels of prophecy are, and he describes this as the lowest of them. The Spirit that came upon all of the Shoftim, this is the same phrase that is used in the context of Gidon and Shimshon and other Shoftim. And it is the lowest level of nevuah in which a person, the way the Rambam describes it, a person is able to act beyond the normal physical abilities in order to help those who are in trouble, in order to help a tzaddik, in order to help Am Yisrael. So Shaul here, who is going to act in that way to help the oppressed and to help Am Yisrael, is seized with this spirit. And Vaykach Tzaron Bakar, what did he do? He took a team of oxen. Remember what I said about a breed. Vayinatchehu, and he cut them up. Vayishalach b'chol gvul Yisrael. Now this should certainly sound evocative. We'll get to it in a minute. He sent these pieces of oxen, throughout the whole borders of Israel, Biyara Malachim, with these same messengers. Lemor asher ineni yotzei achrei Shaul v'achrei Shmuel kol yaseh liv karo. And he said, anybody who does not come with me and Shmuel, so he associates himself with the Navi, to go out to war, this is what will happen to his oxen. Notice, he does not say this is what will happen to you. This will happen to his oxen. And so everybody was afraid, and they came out to fight. In other words, Shaul scared them into coming out to fight as one nation, which is, by the way, something we have not seen since the days of Yoshua, for all the people to come out and fight as one nation. And so he counted them in Bezek. We're familiar with Bezek from Shoftim. So there's 300,000 of members of Israel and another 30,000 of Yehuda, which, by the way, is very telling, because it tells you that the geographic split between Israel and Yehuda is something that predates even David, and that was always a geographic and perhaps a social division that begins well before the split monarchy and parenthetically extends way beyond the split monarchy till the time when the Mishnah talks about Minhag Yehuda and Minhag Galil. And that's how many soldiers he has, which was a very, very fair showing for something still in the period or the shadow of the period of the Shoftim. So this is what they told them. Go tell the people in Yavesh Gilad. Machar tiyeh lachem tshuva kechom ha-shamesh. Tomorrow at the heat of day, meaning by noon, you will be saved. So they came and told the people in Yavesh, and the people in Yavesh were very happy. So they got a message. Obviously, they're very happy. They got a message from Shaul that within 24 hours, and it's by tomorrow at noon, you will be saved. So now, what did they say? They said to Nachash, Machar, when we have to assume this is now the seventh day, Machar netzei alechem asitem lanu kachol atov beinechem. There's a luscious play on words here. They said, tomorrow we'll come out and you will do what's good in your eyes. Alluding to them, hinting that, you know, you're going to take our eyes out. But they didn't say that. Alright, so we're going to see, in a moment, we'll see the victory. And but before that, I want to comment on some of the passages that we've already noted. In Tanakh, we often have in narrative a tension which is created. We might call it opening up a circle, raising a question of how that circle will be closed, if ever. And then the tension is resolved. Of course, classically, the tension of what's going to happen when the four kings take Lot hostage. Conversely, what's going to happen to Lot and his daughters in the cave? What's going to happen to Yaakov when he runs away from Esav? What's going to happen with Yaakov when Lavan catches up with him? What's going to happen when Yaakov and Esav have their reunion and Esav seems to be threatening? And of course, famously, what's going to happen when the brothers finally come before Yosef in Egypt and Yosef recognizes them? How is he going to treat them? What's going to happen when Binyamin is caught with the stolen cup? All of these tensions, and they get resolved. The book of Shoftim ends with a lot of tension. It ends with tension insofar as one Shevet, and remember, all of Shoftim is about tribalism. Tribes do not work together except ad hoc and for a short time, and often bitterly. And so one of the tribes has been nearly erased, the tribe of Binyamin, and the focus of the acts which led to that happened in the town called Givat Binyamin. That's where the terrible crime against the Pilegesh took place, and that's and that becomes the focus of that attack. And as part of that attack, the most horrific scene, which might be the most horrific scene in all of Tanakh, is when the Pilegesh is cut up into 12 pieces and sent around the country to rally people to war. Now we find all of those circles closing in, and by the way, as part of that, part of the solution there is to massacre the Jews living in Avish Gilad. Now we have a resolution to all of it. And now we can sense that the terrible sense that we ended up with in the end of Sefer Shoftim is now coming to a positive direction, a positive resolution. The end of Shoftim, we saw tribes killing each other. We saw one tribe being nearly massacred. We saw the Jews in Yavesh Gilad being massacred to provide wives for the remnants of this tribe. We saw Givah as being the lightning rod for all of that destruction. We saw this terrible scene of the Pilegesh being cut up. What do we have here? Here we have Shevet Binyamin not being the target of Jews' wrath, but rather the flagship around which everybody else rallies. The leader who calls them together comes from Binyamin and comes from no less of a town than Givah itself. Great redemption. Beyond that, this same king, instead of cutting up Lo Aleinu, a woman, and sending her through the nation, cuts up cattle. With a threat, not a threat that we have to go and kill other Jews, but rather a threat that we have to come and defend other Jews. And which Jews do we end up defending? The Jews of Yavesh Gilad, who we end up saving, as we'll see in the next few moments, but we can already anticipate it, who in the previous tension-filled and tension-laden encounter were the victims of such animosity and such violence. And so therefore, we see that this chapter really serves to not only bring things full circle, but to, in a sense, make us feel a lot better about there being a king, and Dafka, a king from Binyamin, as if to say that many of those errors, if we want to be kind about it, are now being repaired and atoned for. In any case, back to our regularly scheduled war. Vayim Macharat, so the next day, Vayasim Shol Ta'am Shlosha Rashim, he set the people up into three different attack groups, which should remind us, of course, of Gidon, and that again reminds us that Shaul is operating in the mode of Shoftim. The only difference between Shaul and a Shofet is that Shaul is anointed, and the anticipation is that Shaul's son will take over and we have a dynasty. But besides that, he's operating as a chieftain, and even uses the same strategies, just like Gidon did with the three different groups. And again, very much like Gidon, attacked and came at first light, and they wiped them out until midday. And the ones who were left ran away. They didn't even run in pairs. They scattered so that everyone was running on his own. So now the people turned to Shmuel and said, who were these people who said, was Shaul really going to rule over us? In other words, his loyalists now use this as an opportunity to take those people who at the end of Perek Yod degraded him and said, who is this going to save us? And they said, it's an opportunity for us to get rid of them. Let's kill those guys. And they said this to Shmuel. But who's the only person who can really forgive those people and save their lives? It's Shaul. Vayomer Shaul, lo yumat ish b'yom hazeh. He said, nobody should be dying this day. Today God has saved the Jewish people, and therefore today is not a day in which we're going to kill each other, recriminations, sort of an amnesty. Remember that line, because at the end of Perek Yodalad it's going to come back to haunt Shaul. In any case, these next two psukim properly belong to Perek Yodbet, but pro forma we will read them and study them here. And Shmuel now sees that the people are ready for a proper coronation and a full acceptance of Shaul, because no matter how divinely inspired the choice of a king is, if the people are not willing to accept him and embrace him as their leader, it is worth nothing. And so now, after the war with Yavesh Gilad, where Shaul has proven himself and has gained the people's trust, then we are ready for a proper coronation. So, Vayomer Shmuel al'am, l'chu v'nalcha ha-Gilgal, v'nechadesh ha-Malucha. Let us go to Gilgal, and let us renew the Malucha, and have a proper coronation. Why Gilgal? Perhaps this associates itself again with what I mentioned earlier, that in Gilgal, the shame of Egypt was rolled away, hence the name Gilgal. A brit was made there, which indicated that we are fully committed to God and God alone, not slaves of anyone else. Perhaps that's the most appropriate place to forge a covenant with a king, where the king becomes not an deity by himself, as was common in the other nations, but rather a go-between or an agent of God for the people. And an agent of the people. So what happened? They went to Gilgal. They crowned him. What does the Fnei Hashem mean? Again, as I asked before, it's unclear. Maybe they built an altar, as we'll find out in a minute. It may be that somebody stood there with an ephod. And maybe just that they imagined this and they described it as being in front of God. They brought shlamim lifnei Adonai, vayismach sham Shaul v'chol anshei Yisrael ad meod, and they all rejoiced greatly. And this seems to be really the high point. However, things will not be so simple, because we will find several difficulties. And this last pasuk that we read is more of a summary of what we're about to read, and we're going to go through Perek Yod Bet tomorrow and see the details of this coronation, but we'll see it is not nearly as simple as presented in those last psukim. In any case, we will pick up with Perek Yod Bet with chapter 12 in the next podcast, and everyone should have a wonderful day.